I hope we had a good lecture yesterday with Lucien. Everything was clear with the operational approach, hopefully.
More or less.
More or less, yeah. Any questions about that?
So, now that he's not here.
Yes.
How well accepted is his axiomatization? Or, like, people actually.
People do like what he's done. There's a long tradition of this sort of approach, axiomatizing this sort of way. Lucien's axiomatization is particularly clear, but it's not as if people have given up on trying to find axioms. There are sort of other approaches to finding axioms which are sort of orthogonal to his. You start in a different place, and people are still motivated to try to do that, come up with a different set, of short list of axioms. So there's a lot of activity these days in that. Yes?
Why isn't the program for axiomatization for classical mechanics as well understood or as well defined? Is there a power program for the axiomatization of classical mechanics? Or, I mean, do we actually have an axiomatic approach to classical mechanics? And if not, why are we concerned about an axiomatization of quantum mechanics? So, more philosophical question.
I'm not aware of the activity in axiomatizing classical mechanics. I mean, I think perhaps some of the historical work in classical mechanics can be thought of as an axiomatization, like the work of Hamilton and Lagrange, which sort of unified a whole bunch of stuff and tried to boil down the content of classical mechanics to a few simple principles. But there's probably more that could be done. Perhaps people are motivated to axiomatize things when they don't understand them sufficiently well, hoping to get a better understanding. So I think the field of thermodynamics has seen activity in this regard because there's still some puzzles, the arrow of time and the status of the second law of thermodynamics. So people do try to axiomatize that still today. I don't know if that's a good answer or not. Yeah?
Axiomatize things when they don't understand them. And classical mechanics is extremely intuitive, right? And a lot of people, for example, are willing to accept the action principle without any sort of justification just because it makes a lot of sense. When you get classical things like probability theory, classical probability theory, that people don't quite understand, there's a huge push to axiomatize. And, like, for example, that's why Kolmogorov is famous, because he was the first one to do it. And even after Kolmogorov, there was a big industry of axiomatizing probability theory.
So we're going to move on today to start talking about realist approaches. So this is going to be a very gentle introduction to realism. And I'm going to go through some of the features of a realist approach. And it's all going to seem very obvious, but no matter how obvious an assumption seems, there's probably somebody out there who's denied it at some point in their attempt to try to understand quantum theory. So it's useful to sort of go over what's typically left implicit, just to know, what there is that you could possibly abandon. So, realist talk. So, as a realist, what sorts of concepts do we use? Well, there are entities. So, in this example, there are toy blocks. Those things have attributes, color, shape, taste, things like that. And then it's important to distinguish the attributes from instances of the attribute. So red, blue, green are instances of the attribute color. This distinction becomes important in things like modal interpretations. Of course, we're used to mathematizing this. So attributes we refer to as variables. Instances of attributes are valuations of those variables. Features that realist theories tend to have, scientific theories, they tend to be atomic, which means that macroscopic entities can be thought of as composed of more fundamental entities. So that's just the atomic hypothesis, which is common in physics. And they tend to be reductionist, which means that the state of the composite system, any composite system, can be specified in terms of the states of all the fundamental entities that make up that composite system. All right. Let's consider an example of the in Newtonian physics, how various aspects of a realist formalism appear. So the fundamental entities in Newtonian physics are particles. The attributes are just things like position, momentum, energy. Instances of an attribute, such as position, would just be the different possible values positions could take. To specify a set of independent attributes is to specify a set of variables that can be varied independently of one another. So position and momentum would be an example. Position and velocity would be another example. And then the notion of a state is going to be very important. That's a complete specification of the instances of some set of independent attributes. Okay, so if I tell you the values of position and momentum, I've told you everything there is to know about that particle by the lights of Newtonian physics. And the state space is just all the possible valuations of those. Okay, so those should be pretty familiar concepts. Another notion that's important is determinism. So a definition of determinism, which I like, this is the standard sort of definition you find is the one that was given by Laplace, which says that if a superintelligent being knew the position and momenta of all the particles and knew the law of motion, the Hamiltonian, then that being could compute exactly what would happen in the future and what had happened in the past, and nothing would be hidden from them. So that is a notion that depends on the idea of some agent knowing something. But determinism can also be formulated as having nothing to do with knowledge, but having to do with just reality. So in philosophy, that's the difference between ontology and epistemology. Ontology is the study of what's real. Epistemology is the study of what we can know. So an ontological definition of determinism is that the law of state evolution is such that for each state that is possible at a given time, there's a unique state possible at every future and earlier time. So we don't have to talk about knowledge. But note that this is what the philosophers call a counterfactual notion. So a counterfactual statement is one that says, if it were the case that X, then it would be the case that Y. So to understand whether the theory is deterministic or not, you can't just look at the actual evolution of the universe. You have to say, if it had been the case that at time T, things were different, then would I be able to infer what things looked like at later times and earlier times? Okay, so it's not a trivial notion. Good. Okay, so we can also look at our various realist models and ask whether they're deterministic. Yes?
Like to talk about the ontological determinism without without doing counterfactually. Like, for example, like it seems like there should be. Like, I can say I have this universe, it's the only universe. But for example, you could phrase it as some sort of like compressibility argument. The idea that I can make a computer program or something that calculates it's difficult. Like, for example, if the universe were infinite, then I could easily phrase it. I can say that determinism is just the idea that looking at a finite part of the universe, I can calculate the whole universe. And I don't have to think about all the possible universes. All I have to think about is calculating this one. Is that reasonable?
If it's possible to calculate the future from the present, for example, then there can only be one future consistent with that present. So I think you're relying on sort of this epistemological version of determinism when you do that. You're saying, you know, if not being a superintelligent being, if I just have enough information, then perhaps I can predict the future well enough, which is essentially Laplace's definition. Is that fair?
I don't
know. Chris?
Just could you say again the ontological definition of realism? Just one of it.
Yep. So if it's the case that the law of evolution is such that for a given state at one time, the state at any future time is uniquely specified, and the state at any earlier time is uniquely specified, then your theory is deterministic.
Okay.
If at a given time, if you say, you tell me the complete state at one time, but the state of the future time is not uniquely specified, there are many future states that are consistent with that state at time t, then you say that's an indeterministic theory. Indeterministic theories come along with a lot of difficult philosophical baggage because you need to make sense of the notion of objective probabilities typically in those sorts of theories. But there are other kinds of you can build theories that are deterministic in one direction and not the other. So I remember David Albert came up with an example. Imagine a universe where particles move around, and there's a grid, and there's sort of blue points on the grid. And forward in time, it moves, and at a certain time interval, it hops to the nearest blue point, and then it continues with the same momentum it had. So that works fine. It's deterministic forward in time. But if you go backward in time, you've lost the information about where it came from. And so it's not deterministic backward in time. And there are no probabilities in that theory. So you can construct interesting examples. Yes?
Were you saying before that if a theory is deterministic, then is non-deterministic, then the probabilities are automatically objective?
Yeah, I probably shouldn't say anything that strong. I just want to say that typically when people explore indeterministic theories, they take on board the notion that there are such things as objective probabilities. Okay. Yeah, particularly in quantum mechanics, indeterministic theories tend to involve objective probabilities. But as I said, that example I just gave was one that was indeterministic backward in time, but that didn't involve any objective probabilities.
And all the probabilities we've been dealing with all week, should we think of them as objective or subjective or whatever?
So I think that the probabilities we've been talking about in the operationalism section can be understood subjectively as epistemic probabilities. You know, if I know that the experimental procedure had such and such details in it, then what do I know about the outcomes of these experiments? You know, what can I say about them? So I think you're safe with that sort of interpretation. If you're interested, you'll find that actually there's, even among people who believe that probabilities are not objective, there's debate as to how to interpret them, right? So there's the frequentist approach, and there's the radical subjective approach, or the Bayesian, radical Bayesian approach. And the radical Bayesians would say probabilities are just encodings of degrees of subjective belief. Whereas, you know, the frequentists want to say, no, it's something like the ratio of events in some infinite ensemble. And oftentimes, some of the time these can be important distinctions and other times not. But even, for example, in Lucien's axiomatization scheme, he took a relatively frequentist approach to probability, and Rüdiger Schaff wrote a paper saying that, you know, you could do the same thing with a Bayesian approach. Even if you're in the operationalist framework, as Lucien's axiomatization was, there can still be debate about what the appropriate interpretation of probability is there. There are about as many debates on the interpretation of probability as there are on the interpretation of quantum mechanics. So.
the other thing I wanted to ask is, you don't have to go into it if you want, but Yakir Aronoff,
yes.
And he showed us this thing with the, he had two vectors, one in the future, one in the past. And
yeah, I don't think I'm going to talk about that. We'd need more time. All right, let me continue. So properties are a particular kind of attribute. They're an attribute that has only two instances. So a property is something that either holds or fails to hold. And in Newtonian physics, for example, or in any classical theory, they're associated with regions of the state space. So for example, if I just have a harmonic oscillator, that's the energy function, then the property of having an energy between E1 and E2 is just associated with this elliptical ring in the phase space. So if your state lies within this region, then you have that property. If you lie outside that region, you don't have the property. So often realists talk about properties, and so it's useful to know exactly what they mean by that. Let me give you an example. So suppose you have an attribute like this one. So this is just a function over the phase space. It takes three different values depending on which of three regions you're in the phase space. So it's like the energy function, but a little bit simpler. And you can rewrite it now as a sum of these chi's, which are called characteristic functions. And you can think of these as being associated with the different possible properties. So there's one property of, you know, being in the region position less than x1. There's another property being between x1 and x2. And a third being greater than x2. This distinction between attributes and properties is very much like the distinction between Hermitian operators and projector-valued measures. So remember, when we had Hermitian operators, they had an eigenvalue spectrum. We measure them, we get a particular eigenvalue. That's like thinking about some function over the phase space. You might measure it, get a particular value. But to calculate the probability, all you really need to know is the properties that function corresponds to. And the value is not so important for calculating the probability. So if I had a distribution over the phase space, I would just ask what fraction of it lies in each of these regions to figure out the probabilities for those properties. OK. Now, this is one of the key distinctions for the next couple of lectures, the distinction between ontic states and epistemic states. So remember, ontology and epistemology, these comes from the Greek words ontos and episteme, meaning reality and knowledge. So an ontic state is going to be just shorthand for a real state of affairs, so a physical state, complete specification of the values of all the variables in the system. An epistemic state is a state of knowledge. So you have seen these things appearing in physics. If you do statistical mechanics, then you draw a probability distribution over the phase space. And sometimes that's called the Liouville state. And you have an equation that evolves that probability distribution forward in time. You have a differential equation for the probability distribution. So you start thinking of that probability distribution as a state. But what it really corresponds to is not a state of reality, because if you look at the relative height, so here's a phase space, that would be an ontic state, just a point in the phase space. And a distribution over it, which is normalized and positive, would be an epistemic state. The relative height of that distribution at different points says nothing about the system itself. What it says is your relationship to the system, what you think the relative likelihood of it being here and here are. Or it talks about the properties of an ensemble of systems. Right? So if you prepare many, many systems in some fixed way, and they have a distribution of properties, then you might say this relative height describes the relative fraction of systems that have one property or another. But it says nothing about the actual properties of the individual system. OK, so this is going to be a really important distinction. Let me give you a quote by James, which I quite like, for this distinction in the context of quantum mechanics. He says, our present quantum mechanical formalism is not purely epistemological. It is a peculiar mixture describing in part realities of nature, in part incomplete human information about nature, all scrambled up by Heisenberg and Bohr into an omelet that nobody has seen how to unscramble. Yet we think that the unscrambling is a prerequisite for any further advance in basic physical theory. For if we cannot separate the subjective and objective aspects of the formalism, we cannot know what we are talking about. It is just that simple. So I strongly believe this as well, that we have to be, that in foundations we have to be particularly careful to make this distinction between whether we're talking about reality or whether we're talking about our knowledge of reality. And anytime you let those things blur, you let conceptual confusion in the door. So we're going to try to be careful to keep that distinction in mind at all times. Okay, so what I want to do to start off talking about realism is connect it up with the operational approach. So we saw that the operational approach gives you a minimal interpretation of quantum mechanics. It says, well, whatever quantum mechanics is saying about the world, it's certainly saying this, that if you do certain things in the lab, you'll get certain frequencies of outcomes. And so we have to do justice to that. Any realist model we propose ought to be able to explain the success of this sort of approach. It ought to explain the statistics that we see in experiments. So how are we going to do that? Well, here's the idea. So we have a preparation procedure, right? I've done a bunch of stuff in the lab. I've pressed go, and we're off. A realist model is going to say, when you do that, what you've done is prepared a system. So there's actually a system that gets emitted from this preparation device, and it has some properties. It has a physical state. Now, you might know, by virtue of knowing the details of this preparation procedure, maybe you know everything there is to know about that physical state. That's conceivable. So that's one possibility for a realist model. But more generally, you might have limited knowledge of that, of the physical state of this system, the ontic state of this system. You might only know that with some probabilities, you know, it's in this region, you know, probability zero, it's outside this region, and with some probabilities, it's in this region. So here, this axis here denotes just some space of ontic states. So every realist model is going to make a presumption about what the space of ontic states are. So I'm just going to denote it this way. And for every preparation procedure, you might have some distribution over those ontic states, corresponding to knowing which preparation procedure was done.
So that would be an epistemic distribution?
So exactly. So what you're presuming is that every time you use the preparation procedure, the system gets prepared in some ontic state, but all you know is some distribution over ontic states. You can also think of this at, yes?
And the y-axis is probability?
Yes,
and the area under the graph is 1.
I'm sorry? And the integral of the graph is 1. That's right. So the overall probability of finding it somewhere is 1. There's another question. Yes, Michael?
I'm really confused about
this. Okay.
So in an operational point of view, you could say I have a preparation procedure, and it gives me a density matrix, which is represented by a point in the Bloch sphere.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a realist statement? That is, that my object, my state, is the density matrix, and what I believe is the object state is the point in the Bloch sphere that I have created?
Well, so far we've seen three notions of state in this class. So let's distinguish them. Let's call the first one the operational state. So the idea is there a mathematical object that does the following for me? It allows me to predict the probabilities of the outcomes of any future measurement. The answer is, yes, the density operator will do that for me. So it's an operational state in that sense. How do I interpret it? I say, oh, it just is a representation of a catalog of my expectations of the outcomes for those future measurements. It represents the preparation procedure. It says, if you've seen this preparation, then here's what you should expect about all future measurements. It makes no claims about the properties of systems, nor claims about what you know about the properties of systems. It's just referring to these macroscopic devices. But now somebody else could come along and say, yep. Yep.
Standing state. But another person could go and say, well, the density matrix is real.
That's right. So if you want to go beyond operationalism and you want to say this density operator represents not just a list of instructions of what I did in the lab, but more, then you can start fighting about whether it represents, for example, a point in a physical state space, or perhaps a distribution. It's just some funny mathematical representation of a distribution over some physical state space that has an interesting form. And in just a couple of slides, we'll see examples of that. Okay. So the other interpretation you could have is just that this preparation procedure, if I use it many times, I'll generate an ensemble of systems. And this distribution could represent the relative frequency with which various physical states appear in that ensemble. So either I'm going to use those two ways of talking interchangeably. Probability distributions are relative frequencies and ensembles, or they're your knowledge about a single system drawn from that ensemble. Okay. Now, how do we model measurements? So operationally, a measurement is just a list of instructions what to do in the lab. In a realist model, it says, no, it takes in a system, and its outcome tells you something about the properties of that system. And so one thing it could do is that it could tell you precisely what the physical state of the system is. That's one sort of measurement you can imagine, which we can conceive of classically. But in general, you might find that all it tells you is that the physical state of the system is in some region of the state space. So it might tell you, you know, which of various different properties holds. So that would just be carving up the state space into different regions. But even more generally than that, it could be that a particular outcome has different probabilities of occurring depending on for a particular physical state. So again, this is just some physical state space. Suppose the physical state is a point over here, then these three distributions correspond to the probability of the measurement giving outcome 1, given that the physical state was lambda. So if the physical state's over here, then with probability 1, you'll get the first outcome. But if it's over here, then there's a probability you'll get the first outcome and a probability you'll get the second outcome. So you could imagine that sort of thing happening. Maybe that's what measurement devices are doing. They're responding to what the physical state is, but they respond probabilistically to some physical states. So this is just some arbitrary set of conditional probabilities that you can write down. They have to sum to 1 at all lambda, because some outcome has to occur for every physical state you feed into the device. Yes?
I have to ask, is this epistemic or ontic?
So here, the ontic states are all the points along this space. So lambda will be my conventional notation for an ontic state. These are conditional probabilities. So they're also epistemic. They're the probability you assign to getting outcome one if you knew that the ontic state was lambda. You may not know that the ontic state is lambda. You may only know this about the ontic state, right? You may say it's a distribution. So you could say, well, what do I know about what do I assign to the probability of getting outcome one if I only know this? And that's this integral here. You say, you know, here's the probability of lambda given that I know the preparation procedure was P. Here's the probability of getting outcome K given that I measured M and the state was lambda. And now I integrate over lambda, and that gives me the overall probability of outcome K given that preparation procedure P and measurement procedure M were implemented. This is the constraint that your realist model has to satisfy in order to reproduce the predictions of your operational theory. Because remember, your operational theory, basically, what it did for you was it specified these guys. It said, for all the different things you might do as preparation procedures and all the different measurement procedures, the operational theory will tell you probabilities of different outcomes. So it's given you this stuff. Your task as a modeler is to come up with distributions, epistemic states, and these things, which I call indicator functions, come up with epistemic states and indicator functions such that you can reproduce the operational statistics. If you've done that, then you've satisfied the first criteria of a realist model. Is that clear? Yes?
How would we represent an ontic probability distribution that represents that there's some... All right, because given this, if we had like a delta function for our epistemic probability distribution of ontic states, and we did a measurement on that, our indicator function was, you know, but again, a delta, of course, pointing to the fact that we know exactly what happens for each state.
Yes.
Then that gives us a deterministic theory, right?
Yes. Then that would be unlike quantum mechanics in that you could always predict precisely which outcome of the measurements would occur.
But I mean, there's... Yes.
But how do we get uncertainty in the quantum case?
Yeah, it seems like the only way we get uncertainty in this is through
epistemic. Yes, so far I haven't specified that the underlying ontic model needs to be deterministic. So if you want to build a model that's objectively indeterministic, you can do that in various ways. So for example, you could say that your measurement device responds probabilistically, okay? And there's no facts of matter in the world. There are no variables in the device or in the system which tell you how it's going to respond. So those events could be objectively indeterministic. So you could put it in there. You could also put it in the transformations, in the law of evolution. So this is the other criterion you have to satisfy is, remember, we had these other sorts of procedures, the transformation procedures. So the realist is going to have to do justice to them. So the realist says, right, that transformation, what it does is it says, if you feed a physical system with ontic state lambda into the device, then there's a probability that it makes a transition to lambda prime. So here I've drawn sort of different lambdas. And for every lambda, there's a distribution over lambda prime. Right? So it could be a permutation. It could be a one-to-one map between lambdas and lambda primes, in which case that would just be a curve running through that space. But more generally, it could be that for a given lambda, there's different probabilities of various lambda primes coming out the other side of the transformation procedure. And if those probabilities were interpreted as objective probabilities, well, that would be an indeterministic theory. It would say that if you just do the transformation corresponding to wait a couple of seconds, then your ontic states will evolve indeterministically. So you need to specify, for every transformation procedure, you need to specify some conditional probability from the space of ontic states back to itself for that transformation. And it needs to satisfy this equation, right? If I take my posited distributions, right? So for every preparation, I've posited a distribution over ontic states. And now I map them with this conditional probability. So now this whole thing, when I integrate, gives me a distribution over lambda prime. And then I integrate that with my indicator function, which gives me the probability for outcome k. Sorry, this should be a lambda prime. given lambda prime, then I should get the overall probability of outcome k, given that I did this preparation, followed by this transformation, followed by this measurement.
I guess more or less the same question that I asked before.
So, yep.
For any real experiment that you will do, this gamma t is a convolution of some probability that comes from variables over which we don't have control, noise, and some in principle intrinsic probability distribution. And your question, the question that we can ask later is that intrinsic probability of distribution a delta function, in which case it's a deterministic theory, or does it actually have some probability, some non-trivial spread?
Yes, I think I agree with what you said. What often happens in these sorts of models, so for example, in a lot of hidden variable models of quantum theory, is that the unitary evolution, the unitary transformations, are modeled by permutations. So they are deterministic transformations in the model. And the irreversible transformations, the ones that are not unitary, are modeled by stochastic maps, ones that for which it's not just a permutation of the optic space, but where you actually add noise to the system. And that sort of makes sense, because in the operational approach, we saw that to get those non-unitary evolutions, we either had to, you know, roll the dice and do one of many things, and so we've got some extra degrees of freedom, namely the dice, that we're then ignoring, or we couple to some ancilla system, and then we ignore the ancilla system. So in a hidden variable model, you could always say, well, that extra stochasticity, if you want to, you can say that extra noise came from information about that extra system, which we're then ignoring. So you don't have to assume that there's objective indeterminism to make sense of those irreversible evolutions. You could say, no, it's deterministic. It depends on the ontic states of the ancilla, and then we're ignoring the ancilla.
Okay. But at this moment, yep. All possibilities are open.
That's right. Here I'm trying to define a very general framework.
I think that's actually the answer to Chris's question. Did I get this right?
I think. I'm still trying to...
Yeah, when we get to some specific models, you'll see that what I'm doing here is I'm not telling you here's a particular model, but I'm saying here's sort of a general framework wherein you can express the content of your model. If you want to write down a particular model, here's a language in which you can do it. So it's very generic at this stage. It's not really committed to much yet. But this is the minimum that it has to do. You know, for every preparation, measurement, and transformation, it's got to specify these objects. And then finally, every measurement also induces a transformation. If I let the system pass out of the measurement device, we talk less about this in the operational and in part of the course, but there's a set of transformation procedures associated with the different outcomes of a measurement. And for each of those, I'm going to need a conditional probability, right? So this is going to be, how do I map the ontic state coming into the measurement device to ontic states coming out of the measurement device, given that I got outcome one? And it could be deterministic, it could be probabilistic. It's all up to your model to decide. But if I have some operational probabilities, whatever you assume, I better reproduce those operational probabilities. Okay, so that's it. Those are the things that your model has to explain. Now let's consider a few different types of model that you might be interested in. So this is a classification, I guess, that I and a co-author introduced. I find it useful, but bear in mind that this is sort of an idiosyncratic way of describing things. So if you speak to somebody else in foundations, they might not like this way of classifying things. But I think it's kind of useful. So I'm going to distinguish three kinds of models: psi-complete, psi-supplemented, and psi-epistemic. And they all have to do with how psi, the pure quantum state, is dealt with in those models. So this is a very heuristic version of what it means. A psi-complete one is one that says that the ontic states of the system are just the pure quantum states. And here I mean the rays in Hilbert space. So the extra phase degree of freedom in a vector, I'm modding that out. So I say the rays in Hilbert space are all the different possible ontic states. So the ontic state space is just projective Hilbert space. This is the orthodox perspective. right? It's representational completeness of psi. So that's one view you could take. Note that it's not an operational view. It's realist. It says, no, there is a physical state of the system, and it's completely described by psi. The psi supplemented view is one that says, yes, psi describes something about the reality of the system, but it doesn't describe everything. So there's some other variables, some other attributes. So here I've just denoted all of those others by omega, just to make it simple. So the complete state, the ontic state of the system, which I just denote by lambda, is given by specifying the quantum state and these other variables, supplementary variables. So a lot of hidden variable models, in fact, most hidden variable models have that form. They postulate the quantum state as something real, something physical, but there are extra variables in addition to it. The third option is one wherein there's some ontic state, lambda, and there's no sense in which the quantum state describes an axis in your physical state space. Rather, the quantum state describes different possible distributions over that physical state space. So here, the quantum state is not considered a physical state at all. OK, so I'm going to be clear on that distinction in just a moment. Yes?
Why do people still discuss hidden variable theory? I thought Bell's paper had more or less sort of done away with it.
Well, we'll be getting to Bell's result next week. And I think the answer is that Bell's result does not rule out. So if you're committed to realism, okay, if you're an operationalist, then I think you can make a case that, you know, maybe hidden variable models are uninteresting, just as any realist model is uninteresting. But if you're committed to realism and you say, well, I have the choice of going to hidden variables, or maybe I have a choice of being a, you know, many worlds-er or a collapsed theorist or something else, or no hidden variables, you know, maybe this sort of perspective. For most of those approaches, Bell's theorem applies. So it's not the case. There's a bit of a misconception that Bell's theorem shows that hidden variable approaches have to be non-local and others can salvage locality. It's rather Bell's theorem shows that if you want to be a realist, then your model has to be non-local. And in fact, adding hidden variables was the best chance you had at securing locality. It turned out it failed. So I'm going to take you through the narrative of how basically Einstein showed that if you're one of these guys, then it's very easy to show that your model has to be non-local. You didn't have to wait for Bell to show it. And if you're one of these guys, I'll argue it's also relatively easy to show. The only case where you need the big guns of Bell's theorem are for these sorts of approaches. Yes? Oh, go ahead. Yeah. Go ahead. Yes?
Is that a probability distribution in the psi epistemic? And if so, what happens when psi is complex? Or?
Well, so I don't mean that you should think of this as a position and this is mod psi squared, but rather that there's some other way of writing down psi. So if you're familiar with the Wigner representation, that doesn't quite work either, but many more quantum states can be represented as positive functions over phase space with a Wigner representation. Yes?
Yeah, so this is actually related to my question. So I might have misheard you, but did you say that the psi, that hidden variable theory is in the psi supplemented or psi epistemic class usually?
Well, so hidden variable theories, let me go to the next one. These are the hidden variable models, psi supplemented and psi epistemic, in the sense that they're both psi incomplete. So this is psi complete. Psi told you everything about the physical state. Psi incomplete models are where psi does not tell you everything. And so I use the term hidden variable model in the following way. If I tell you everything about the preparation procedure, do you know the physical state? In a psi complete model, you do. Nothing is hidden to someone who knows the details of the preparation procedure. In either of these models, someone who knows the details of the preparation procedure does not know something, namely the extra variables or the underlying variables. And so in that sense, there's something hidden to them. Yes?
Yeah, maybe this is a stupid question, but why is there no fourth one?
That's because I jumped ahead. Let me, if I can wait on your question, let me go through here, get to the next slide, and then I'll come to it. So there's two distinctions that are useful for classifying these models. Psi complete versus psi incomplete. So we've already seen this. You know, psi-complete model, the space of physical states are just the space of Reyes and Hilbert space. Incomplete is one for which that's not true. And then among the psi-incomplete models, there's this distinction. Is it psi-ontic or psi-epistemic? So now here I've been a bit more careful about what I mean. So a psi-ontic model is one such that for any preparation procedures, P1 and P2, that are associated with different quantum states, psi-1 and psi-2, the probability distribution over ontic states for those two preparation procedures don't overlap. So the product is zero. So what that means is that if I tell you the ontic state, if I tell you where you are in this space, you can infer which of those two procedures was done. Was it the one with psi-1 or the one with psi-2? Well, there's no region where they overlap, so it's unambiguous. So in that sense, the physical state of the system encodes which of these two quantum states was prepared. And so there's a sense in which the quantum state is encoded in the reality, right? So different quantum states always correspond to different realities in this model.
When you take procedures, you're not really talking about, like, it's not from the operationalist point of view, it's from...
No, it is the operationalist point of view. I mean, if, you know, these are boxes.
But I can create the same states with two different procedures.
That's true. That's true. So
it's not really...
So what this is saying is that, yeah, if you have two preparation procedures corresponding to the same state, this... you get no constraint in a psi-ontic model. What this says is if you have two procedures that are associated with different quantum states, then the representations have to satisfy this. But yes?
So do you need to have mu lambda, well, the probability of having, of being in the ontic state lambda, mm-hmm. knowing that you prepared the state psi with one procedure, does it have to be the same?
Excellent question. The reason I put this in is because next week we'll see that if you want your realist model to succeed, actually you are going to have to make your mu depend not just on what psi is, but on how you implemented this preparation procedure. What I said is not quite true. It's not really a problem for the pure states, but when you get to density operators, you know, you can have a procedure for a given density operator, and there's many ways of, you know, we saw that there are many different mixtures of pure states that lead to the same density operator. So you could ask, could there be one distribution for a given density operator, as opposed to, you know, different distributions depending on the pure state ensemble? It turns out there's a result that shows that it has to depend on the ensemble, not just the density operator. So that's why I've been careful here to talk about procedures rather than just quantum states. Because if I do it this way, then I can talk about whether a model is psi-ontic regardless of whether it is contextual or non-contextual, which is this issue that you're bringing up. So yeah, hold on to that thought because it's very important for next week. It's one of the most important results in foundations is the proof that you have to have contextuality in your representations. We'll get to that. OK, so the psi-ontic model was that, intuitively speaking, if I tell you the physical state of the system, you can infer whether psi-1 or psi-2 was prepared. Therefore, the quantum state is encoded in that physical state. A psi-epistemic model is one for which there's some pair of quantum states such that the distributions associated with preparations of one and the other do overlap. So for such a case, if I told you the physical state of the system is here in the region of overlap, you could not infer whether psi-1 or psi-2 was prepared, which tells us that the quantum state is not encoded in the physical state of the system. There's still ambiguity about what the quantum state was given the physical state of the system. And so the natural thing to do here is to say, well, that means that psi-1 and psi-2 are descriptions of what you know. They're not descriptions of the reality. Okay, so the intuition is only if the quantum state is encoded into the ontic state do we think of the model as psi-ontic. Otherwise, we call it psi-epistemic. So these are the definitions. I'll give you examples, and hopefully it'll be clear by virtue of the examples. Is it all right if I continue? All right, so this is our categorization. We have the psi-complete, the psi-incomplete, psi-ontic, psi-epistemic. The reason there's no fourth box is because a psi-complete model is not psi epistemic. I mean, once I've told you the quantum state, I've told you everything. So there's nothing in this third corner here. Basically, the word psi supplemented is just a convenient shorthand for psi incomplete and psi ontic. So that's how it works. All right, so let's consider first a psi complete model. So there's your state space. Every psi, there's a different physical state. Now, I can ask, when I tell you that I've just done a preparation procedure associated with psi, how do you represent your knowledge in this state space? What distribution would you use if I said, I've just done a preparation procedure associated with psi?
Sorry, I have a question.
Oh.
Is it accurate to say that in a psionic theory, or a theory is psionic if and only if the ontic state uniquely determines the quantum state?
That's right.
Okay.
Well, they're equal, right?
He was talking about psi ontic theories, not psi complete theories. In psi complete theories, not only does the ontic state determine, not only does the quantum state determine the ontic state. Sorry, not only does the ontic state determine the quantum state, it's they're the same. So the distribution is just a delta distribution, right? So if you know that psi was prepared, then you know that you're here, and you're nowhere else. And so if I change psi, then I'm talking about a different distribution. And the product of those distributions is clearly zero, so it's clearly psi-ontic, right? The distributions don't overlap at all. In a psi-supplemented model, if I know psi, then I have some distribution like this. I mean, maybe it's uniform across these supplementary variables, maybe it has some shape across the supplementary variables. And if I tell you that some other preparation of psi prime was achieved, then it's still a delta function along that axis, that psi-axis. It might have some distribution over the others, but they won't overlap by virtue of being distinct along that one axis at least. So according to our definition, this is psi-ontic. The two distributions don't overlap. If I tell you the physical state, I've told you what the quantum state was. The psi-epistemic one is the only interesting one in this regard, because if I tell you that psi or psi-prime was prepared, you're really talking about two different distributions that overlap. There's ambiguity about what the quantum state was if I tell you the physical state. And so that's what we call psi epistemic. All right, so there's the categorization again. These two here are the ones that have the hidden variables. Yes?
So in psi epistemic theories, you have a single ontic state space,
yes?
Ontic states lambda, and any quantum state psi gives you a classical probability distribution on the space of ontic states.
Yes.
Okay.
And I should say I'm representing these spaces as one-dimensional spaces, but they could be arbitrary complicated, right? So there's no restriction. It could be a manifold, of, you know, with non-trivial topology, whatever you like. It's just some state space. Yes.
We get the really stupid here.
Okay.
In the psi epistemic model, we still though assume that there does exist some ontic state.
That's right. In these models, we're saying we lack information about what? About an underlying physical state.
All right. Is it possible to conceive of an epistemic model that just entirely lacks that?
Well, there are various people who try hard to make sense of states of knowledge while avoiding the question of what it's knowledge about. And personally, I find those approaches hard to comprehend. And I personally like to say, if you're going to talk about knowledge, always tell me what is knowledge about. And if you're a realist, then presumably you want it to be knowledge about some properties of a system. But you know, perhaps there is a way of making sense of that. I'm not going to present that kind of view.
Because it just seems like the burden of proof is like, all right, if you got a better ontic state distribution, state space lambda, what is it?
Yeah, certainly at this stage, you know, if somebody says, oh, I believe in a psi epistemic approach to quantum theory, then you're within your rights to say, right, okay, what's the physical state space? Please tell me so that I know, you know, what's actually going on. And you know, such a proponent would have to say, right, I'm working on it, or yeah, here it is. And I think that's the question that they do have to answer. Yes.
I'm just a little bit confused because in the psi complete and in the psi supplemented, mm-hmm. we have the physical state as like a distribution over psi, and some other thing?
No, the physical state is, again, just a point in the space. It's just that here, when you know that the we've made the definition of psionic versus psi epistemic contingent on, you know, what on features of the distributions corresponding to you knowing psi. So you know that a preparation procedure has been done, which the operationalist associates with psi. Okay, so in this kind of model, in every model, that corresponds to some distribution over the physical state space.
So distribution of what, though?
The distribution is a probability distribution that just represents your knowledge. So I say, okay, well, somebody has just gone to the lab and done a Stern-Gerlach experiment and set things up. Now, my model, which I'm supposing, says that, right, that's a particular distribution over a particular physical state space. Let me give you an example, because I think a lot of these questions will be resolved by some of these models. I think when you start being more definite, often things become clear. Fine. So why don't I present a couple of models, and then let me know if it's become clear or not. So I'm just going to give you some examples of these sorts of models for pure states and sharp, i.e. projective measurements in a two-dimensional Hilbert space. So the simplest example possible. So the orthodox one is one we've seen before at the beginning of the course. There's a couple of guys, Beltrametti and Bugalski, who made it sort of very specific, you know, the claims of, you know, what's real in these sorts of models. Whereas in the textbooks, it's a little bit vague sometimes. There's a few other commitments that come in. So I'm technically speaking talking about their model. And I'm using the block sphere representation. So here, the ontic state space are going to be the points on a sphere. And I'm going to represent those by U rather than by lambda. Okay? And if you know, if you've done a preparation procedure associated with the quantum state up along the spin n direction, then that corresponds to a distribution, which is basically a delta function on the block sphere at the block vector n. Okay. How do you represent measurements? So measurements, they have to be conditional probabilities, such that for every u, for every point on the block sphere, it tells you what the probability of getting up along direction m is. It turns out it's just this function here. Okay. So that corresponds to a distribution, which along the m-axis is at its peak, and it drops off to zero in the perpendicular direction, with that kind of cosine dependence, m dot u. Okay, and so it postulates objective indeterminism, or it says the outcome of the measurement is not determined by a specification of u. The outcome of the measurement is still probabilistic once you've given me u, and it depends in this sort of way. And if you integrate these distributions with these indicator functions, you get a half 1 plus m dot n, and you might remember that from the block sphere as just equivalent to the overlap of the n and the m quantum states. So this is the quantum probability for getting the m up outcome, given that you've prepared up along the n direction. So this model reproduces the quantum predictions. That should be clear. Good. The more interesting ones, the ones that will resolve various questions, are the models that follow. Let me just say a couple of other things about this model. First of all, it's psi-complete because of these delta functions. Second of all, it's psi-ontic. All psi-complete models are psi-ontic because if I look at two different distributions corresponding to different psi, they don't overlap. Okay, now let's get to a more interesting model. So John Bell in the 60s was thinking about hidden variable models, and to show that it was possible to underlie quantum theory with a hidden variable model, he gave this simple example. He said, sure, I can talk about hidden variables. I can make sense of such a model. And here's the idea. There are now two variables. There's u and u prime, and they both vary over the surface of a sphere. Okay. So the ontic state space is the Cartesian product of a sphere and a sphere. That's the full ontic state space. And he postulates that for a state that's spin up along the n-axis, it's associated with the following distribution over these two variables, a delta function at n for u, and a completely uniform distribution for u prime. Okay, so this is my representation of a distribution that's uniform over the sphere. And then for the measurements, he says the indicator function is the following. It depends on u and u prime in the following way. If m, the direction along which you're measuring in the block sphere, dot u plus u prime is greater than 0, then you get the outcome at 1. Otherwise, it's 0. So for all the u and u primes that satisfy this condition, they contribute positively to the probability for this measurement outcome. And everything else doesn't contribute at all. So it's hard to draw that four-dimensional space. So all I've done is I've pointed out that if you look at just u plus u prime, that also forms a sphere. And this measurement is just a hemisphere. It just says, if you find the direction m, and then you ask, is my ontic state in that hemisphere or not? That's all the measurement's doing. It's asking you whether the physical state is here or not. And if you look at these two distributions and you say, what distribution do they yield on u plus u prime? The answer is this distribution, which is basically a cosine that drops off at 0 at the hemisphere perpendicular to n, the preparation axis. So the measurement just says, how much of this probability falls in this hemisphere? And it turns out, if you do the calculation, you multiply the probabilities by the indicator functions, you again get the quantum result. So this model works. It satisfies those constraints it needs to satisfy. Let's take a look. It's certainly psi incomplete because it adds extra supplementary variables. Now, is it psi ontic or psi epistemic? Well, let's look at two different quantum states, n1 and n2, different spin axes. So again, it's hard to represent it graphically. So let's just go with the equation for now. So I have mu n1 times mu n2. The expression for that was given up here. It's 1 over 4 pi delta u minus n, right? The 1 over 4 pi is the trivial uniform dependence on u prime. And so I multiply those two guys together. I get the 1 over 4 pi squared. I get a product of delta functions, and they multiply to 0 because they're delta functions at different points. So the point is here that because these things don't overlap on this space, they don't overlap at all. So it's psi ontic. If you tell me the complete physical state, you've told me what psi is, right? Because you've told me what u is, and that uniquely specifies n1 or n2. So the Bell-Merman model is psi ontic. The particular form I've shown you, by the way, is a variation of Bell's presentation due to Merman, which is why I've called it the Bell-Merman model. Yes?
We don't specify u prime, they're uniformly distributed on the dark anyways there. If we were to just set u prime for every state, like if we turned our, go back a slide, you know, we have a 1 over 4 pi delta u, and if we turn that to a given u prime.
Like a different distribution over u prime.
Yeah.
Yep.
It would still be synoptic.
It would, yeah. It would. But it would.
Because on this particular sphere, they must. So
that's right. It's enough to have them non-overlapping here, okay, to have them non-overlapping overall.
So
that's a psi ontic hidden variable model. Yeah. Sorry. So tell me what's. I don't think I'm understanding.
Every hidden variable is
no, because there are also psi epistemic ones, which is my next example. Here we go. Let's see the psi epistemic model. So this is a model from 1967. In a paper by Koshin and Specker. These guys are going to come up again. They did some important work. So in this paper, sort of at the beginning of the paper, the big result that everybody knows about comes later in the paper. But at the beginning of the paper, they're saying, look, let's show that you can come up with a nice hidden variable model for a two-dimensional system. So they say, OK, well, for every spin up along the n-axis, we're going to associate this distribution. 1 over pi n dot u, if n dot u is positive, 0 otherwise. So again, it's something that drops off as a cosine as you, your state space, sorry, I should have said your state space, again, it's just a sphere, right? So it's just like the first model. But now, if you prepare quantum state up along n, your distribution drops off as a cosine, and it goes to 0 at the for the hemisphere aligned with n. So that's it. That's our probability distribution. The indicator functions are just asking whether you're in the hemisphere that's aligned in the direction of m or not. Okay. And it turns out, if you do that integral, you get the quantum results. This is what Koshin and Specker showed. And I'm hoping that you'll have a chance to do these calculations in the tutorial to verify that these models do work. So it's certainly psi incomplete, because the distributions are not delta functions at the quantum states. But now, is it psi ontic or psi epistemic? Well, consider two different quantum states, n1 and n2. They correspond to distributions that are centered here and here, but they overlap. So if I tell you that, you know, the physical state u is, you know, some point in here, you can't determine from that whether the preparation was of spin up along n1 or spin up along n2. What we're imagining is that those two preparation devices yield ensembles of systems that are distributed in particular ways around this sphere, and they overlap. The only exception is that if n1 is orthogonal, if the two quantum states are orthogonal, so n1 is minus n2, in that case, their overlap is zero. But in all other cases, for any two non-orthogonal states, they have some non-zero overlap. Okay, so does that clarify the difference? There's no second variable, right? Well, no, it is a hidden variable model because it says that if you know the preparation sheet, so you know that it's spin up along n1, you don't know everything there is to know. There's some physical degree of freedom, u, and all you know about it is it's most likely, say it was n1, it's most likely here, it's less likely to be anywhere here, and it's definitely not in this hemisphere here. So there's something that's hidden. What is the value of u that underlies that distribution? You don't know. So that's why it's a hidden variable model.
So in all of this, we've been treating u as the lambda from before, basically.
That's right. Okay. U is the lambda from before. So we've gone for an hour now, I think. Yeah, we started around. So maybe it's worth just ending there, and we can take it from here next time. Thank you.